four, three, two, one. What's up, Mo?
What's up, man?
How are you, buddy? Good to see you, man.
It's good to see you.
I'm glad we decided to get together and do this, you know, and talk. And, you know, it's a crazy subject, right? I mean, you and I have known each other since 2012 when I did Meat Eater. You were there filming when I shot my first deer, which is a very important part of my life, man. And then you went on to direct and produce Parts Unknown with our late friend Anthony Bourdain, and we just thought it'd probably be a good thing to come in here and just talk about him.
Yeah, man, and I'm really grateful for it. You know, it's actually, you know, a lot of people have been saying to me, like, oh, it must be really hard to talk about that. I actually find it kind of the opposite. Like, I want to talk about him. I want to talk about who he was and what that experience was, you know. So thanks, man.
My pleasure, brother. Did you know him before you guys started working together?
No. I met Tony 10 years ago, and I was called in. He had a DP on a show who, at the last minute, canceled, couldn't go to Egypt. So I got a call like a week before, you know. It's like, do you want to go to Egypt with Anthony Bourdain? I was like, fuck yeah, absolutely.
Right.
You know. And so I met him in Cairo, man. Like,
wow.
You know, it was kind of like perfect. Yeah.
Holy shit. That's like Indiana Jones type shit.
Exactly.
Is that,
man,
the episode when you guys ate a camel?
No, we didn't eat a camel.
One?
No. But, you know, I met him there, you know, we started filming, we were on the streets of Cairo, and like, you know, it's like all of a sudden it's thrown into these kitchens. We're just like, we're eating pigeon, you know, it's like, go and cover them cooking pigeon. And, you know, I had seen the show like maybe once before, but I knew who he was and I knew what that adventure was.
Right.
You know, and I was so amped for it. And then there was like this seminal moment on that show where, we go out and we go ripping across the desert with the Bedouin and go out and cook a goat in the ground, you know. And so as we're driving out over the desert, we're like, well, we need some shots from car to car, right? And I was like, well, I'll get on the roof, you know. And there's like this for some reason, there's a four-post bed tied to the roof of this Land Rover. And so I get up there and kind of like, you know, latch my arm around it. And these guys take off at, I swear, 80 miles an hour across the desert. I mean.
And you're on a bed?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely no regard for the fact that, like, I'm on the roof, you know, shooting. And when we got there, we got to camp. I survived it. I had this big black and blue where I was holding on to the four-post bed. And I go over and I show Tony. And that was it, man. From that moment on, he was like, I like this guy. And I started going out with him. You know, I started getting invited to do more shows.
Wow.
So
how many
that
years
was
did
it,
you
man.
Do it? How many years?
10 years.
Wow.
10 years, yeah.
That's crazy. I didn't realize that Parts Unknown was even... Were you doing No Reservations first?
Yeah, so that was a No Reservation show. And then we went to Parts Unknown 5 years ago.
Wow. Yeah, so Parts Unknown's been on for 5 years?
Yeah, right? Yeah. And that, you know, that transition, no Reservation was great, and it really laid the foundation for what we do, what Tony did. I think it really built an audience and a following for him.
That's where I found out about him.
Right, exactly. It was a great show,
yeah.
You know. But that, like, that transition going on to CNN, going into Parts Unknown, that really changed things. So that really opened up a lot of locations and stuff that we didn't have access to before. It opened up, you know, kind of CNN's logistics, Rolodex, and, you know, things that we didn't have at the other network, you know. And so that's, you know, No Reservations was awesome. We did some incredible shows. Parts Unknowns got really fun.
Yeah, that was on another level. I remember watching the change. I was like, okay, this is more him. You know, everything from the opening music to the tone of it and the narration. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. And then, you know, you got to hand it to CNN, too, is like all of a sudden we had these creative partners who were like willing to let him be him, you know,
yeah.
Like willing to let him do a show like the Tokyo show where we're like, you know, really climbing into Japanese subcultures, rope bondage, tentacle porn, you know, all this stuff that most network executives are probably a little bit leery of. You know, CNN was kind of like, you know, go for it, man, be yourself, you know, and let's figure out what this is together. You know,
that's amazing. That really is amazing. And but the, one of the things that really made that show was Tony's narration, because the narration gave you a sense of the way his sort of passion and enthusiasm for the world and for various aspects of cooking and travel and food and culture. Like, you got it through his own words, you know.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're looking for something to do this summer, you might want to check out some of the upcoming fights. Even better if you can catch them up close in person. It's quite an experience. But if you want to get the best seats, you have to act fast. And that's true for a lot of things in life, especially when it comes to hiring for your business. You need to hire the most talented people you can before the competition scoops them up. And to do that, you need ZipRecruiter. And luckily, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. Got your eye on a rock star candidate? ZipRecruiter's invite to apply feature lets you cut the line. Once you review ZipRecruiter's list of the most qualified candidates for your job, you can easily invite your top choices to apply to encourage them to apply sooner. So, amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan to try it for free right now. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/Rogan. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. This episode is brought to you by MeUndies. For most of the year, fancy underwear technology sounds unnecessary. Breathable, quick dry, moisture wicking, anti-odor. It's a bit overkill, right? But then summer hits and the heat comes. Suddenly, all that sounds pretty damn essential. Be prepared for summer like me with MeUndies. So far, I love the items that I've gotten from them. They're all soft, comfortable, and flattering. I recommend it hands down, and don't worry, MeUndies has a cut for every guy with over 10 different styles, ranging from boxer briefs to jock straps to the new and improved ball caddy. Plus, they come in over 100 different colors and prints, ranging from black to all over sharks. No matter what pair you get, it'll have MeUndies' signature super soft micro-modal fabric. It is amazing. So everything is breathable, stretchy, and oh so comfy. They also offer some of the most summer-proof fabric. So breathe. It's perfect for working out or just keeping you cool on those really hot days. And if you're not happy with your first pair of underwear, it's on MeUndies. Summer is coming. Be prepared with my favorite underwear, MeUndies. Comfort for the outside in. Get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/Rogan. That's MeUndies.com/Rogan. Tap the banner to learn more.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it may be in some ways the most important aspect of the show. You know, he is, after all, a writer, right?
Yeah.
You know, and that is how he experienced the world. But actually making the shows and the technical part of actually making the shows, you know, once you'd go through and kind of edit the show, and, you know, none of that voiceover was in at the rough cut phase. And you send it out to him and get his writing back and record that VO. And I keep describing it as like that kind of Dr. Frankenstein lightning bolt to the temples kind of moment where like the monster rises.
Yeah.
It would really just bring the show to life. So this kind of carcass that was laid out in rough cut form on the table all of a sudden just gasped and jumped up, and you know, it was really beautiful, like, to see that and to have, you know, as a director, as a producer, as a creative, you know, at any level, you know, to have that kind of power.
Yeah.
To have his voice and his writing and his introspection and thoughts and, you know, what a like powerful force to work with.
Well, it was a brilliant design the way the show was put together. That narration really did make it something special and different from all those other kinds of shows, because it just, his articulate and insightful and poetic and artistic view of these things, that he had this infectious passion for things. He completely changed the way I thought about cooking. I had always thought about cooking as, oh, this guy knows how to make delicious food. Oh, this place has good ribs. And then when I saw his show, when I saw Parts Unknown, I went, oh, it's an art form. It's just an art form that you eat.
Absolutely.
It's just a temporary art form.
Yeah, and even beyond that, it's an art form that's taking and incorporating all of these greater kind of macro social elements of, you know, where you are, the history of where you are, you know, what people did for a living, what people's ancestors did for a living. You know, it's rooted in so much more. And what I think, you know, ultimately, it's like we kind of joke around a lot and say, like, yeah, it's a food show. It's not a food show, you know. But the reason that worked, I think, is because of what you're saying. And, you know, that food is an art form that incorporates all of these other aspects. And so it can be a jumping point off for exploration into anything you want to talk about.
Yeah.
I talked about the history of a place, the politics of a place, you know. The religion of a place, you know, all of these things that inform who people are. Well, that's all writ into the cuisine of a place or an area, you know.
Yeah, and he was into stuff that wasn't necessarily even like high dollar items. He was into like street food.
Definitely, yeah.
It wasn't just the finest French, you know, bistros where these celebrated world famous chefs were cooking these bizarre small plate sort of masterpieces. No, he would love street tacos.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and again, I think that was kind of like a whole new kind of fresh take on looking at food, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, it's easy to, you know, to look at these kind of high-end French preparations, these highly talented, you know, highly trained French chefs. And there's tremendous beauty in that,
yeah,
and all of those other things we talked about. But to look at the woman on the corner that's, you know, that's making, you know, the best, you know, lingua tacos,
yeah,
like that was revolutionary. And then the realization that all of that greatness, all of that nuance, all of that flavor, you know, contained right within there. That was an access point to it as well. It's just an access point that everyone can afford, that
right,
everyone can go in. And you know, I mean, right place at the right time. I think that people, like, it seems like the culture at large was ready for that, like, experience in food and ready to kind of chase that. Because now, I mean, that's all anyone wants now.
Well, I think it's because of him. I really do, because, I mean, I'm sure that he changed the way I look at things in terms of food.
Yeah.
And I think he had that effect on many people. I mean, you think about how many years was Parts Unknown for 5 and then No Reservations for 9?
No Reservations, yeah, for about 10. And then there was Cook's Tour before that.
Right.
So the original.
All told, a decade and a half of his influence on people's food choices and just appreciation for food. I mean, I know personally I've had some great meals in restaurants, but some of my favorite meals have been like stepping outside of a bar. You know, it's 1:30, you got a little buzz on, and some dude's got a taco truck, and you're like, oh, baby, what do you got over there, my friend? Or in New York, you know, it's late at night, and there's a falafel cart, and some guy's got incredible kebabs. Like, oh, something about street food, man.
Absolutely, man. And, yeah, I kind of keep like a loose running list of my favorite meals, you know, and some of them are on the show and some of them are not on the show. And I'd say, you know, most of them are that, you know, most of them are accidentally stumbling into some place where someone's doing something completely awesome that isn't, you know, some massive 26 course tasting menu, you know.
Right.
And I think it's also about, you know, it's about place, you know?
Yeah.
It's about where you are, the context of where you're eating, what it smells like, what it sounds like, what it looks like, you know, who you're with, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's kind of, I think, another reason the show kind of worked is we had an opportunity to articulate all of those elements, you know? We're able to choose an incredibly interesting guest to sit down with at a really interesting restaurant with, you know, people cooking who have a really interesting backstory in a beautiful place, and then use the power of kind of the magic of TV to, you know, to polish it up and present this version of travel and food in the world that, you know.
And really everywhere too. I mean, you guys covered Asia, you covered Europe, you covered some weird places in the South where people are cooking pigs in their backyard.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just it gave people an understanding of the preparation of food and a view to chefs and this view of chefs as artists. I mean, these chefs look like tattoo artists. They look like, you know, guys who are painters or something, or women who are sculptors. I mean, they're real similar in the way they appear to what we consider artists.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, I mean, what I kind of love about, like, you know, at this point spent a good amount of time in kitchens and a good amount of time around kitchen staff, is there's kind of two elements coming together. There's the artistic element that you're talking about, right? But there's also this very, you know, very earnest working class kind of element to the way a kitchen works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This tough, hard, sweaty work, you know? It's a rough environment, you know? And I think that's kind of part of what makes it so appealing too, is he kind of pulled back the curtain on that, you know, and say, like, these guys are not these inaccessible icons, Paul Bocuse of the world. You know, they are, as much as Paul Bocuse is awesome, you know, they are these kind of rough and tumble, you know, guys that are back there making something really awesome, you know.
Tony also had this sort of punk rock sensibility to it all, too. You know, I mean, that was part of the thing about him that people found appealing, is that they had seen cooking shows before, but they never saw cooking shows where the host gets fucked up, you know? Like, dude, first time I partied with him, I'm like, this guy goes so hard. That was amazing.
Yeah, tell me about it, man.
It was amazing. I was like, I can't believe he can do this all the time. Like, I think one of the first times we ever got hung out together was in Montreal. We were there for UFC fights, and we went out afterwards and got... we had some steaks, and it was just amazing walking into this restaurant, people freaking out. One guy actually had a copy of Kitchen Confidential in the actual kitchen itself and had Tony sign it. It was pretty fucking badass.
Where'd you go? I do not remember. Was it Joe Beef?
No, it wasn't, but he turned me on to Joe Beef, and I've eaten there several times since then. Those guys are coming on the podcast, too.
I love those
Fred
guys.
Fred and Dave. Yeah, they're awesome. They're fucking amazing. That restaurant is one of my favorite restaurants on the planet.
No doubt, man, but they'll hurt you.
Yeah, they keep it coming.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they give you an inch-thick slab of foie gras, you know?
Yes. Well, their show, one of the ones that I really loved was the one where they did... ice fishing. They were on the water, and they had this ice fishing shack, but inside the ice fishing shack they had fine silverware and fine china, and they had bottles of really excellent wine, and they were cooking on a wood stove. They had a wood stove, and they were cooking foie gras like right there on the stove, and then they were laying out what they think makes you a good dinner companion. And, you know, Dave is like, I shut my phone off, I turn it off, I put it away. He goes, I don't check it. I don't put my elbows on the table, you know. And he's like, and I come prepared with stories. And Tony was like, you prepare stories? He goes, I have stories to tell.
Yeah.
I come prepared. Like, to him, it's like not really a performance, but it's an agreement that you're gonna go there and you're gonna share this enthusiasm for this experience together, and you're gonna try to enhance it with your own anecdotes and personality and your own appreciation for the food and the wine, and then afterwards they're smoking Cuban cigars. It's like the whole thing is, it made you want to go eat at a really good place.
Yeah, or in a shack
on a frozen lake
with people who understand that there's an elegance to all of these things, you know, that you can create an environment that has an elegance. And that's, you know, I'd say that's like a hallmark of a lot of the chefs that I've met through the show, is like, you will see that, you know, no matter how big they get, no matter how successful, there is an inherent kind of desire to please on multiple levels.
Yeah.
You know, you'll have, like, I remember we were in Daniel Boulud's house in France, like at his parents' house, right? And so here's Daniel Boulud, like the mega chef, you know? But like running around to all of the crew members, like, do you have something to eat? Are you good? Do you want another glass of wine? Do you want to, like, you know? And it just, inherent to his nature is exactly what you're talking about. This idea that, you know, they have this just ongoing desire to please their guests, to entertain, to, you know, make sure that everyone's taken care of.
They're curators of an experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and so to be able to, you know, run around the world for 10 years and explore that.
Yeah.
It was nice, man.
God, man, I can only imagine.
Yeah.
I could only imagine. How many shows did you guys film together?
I don't, you know, I don't know, 57 or 60, something like that. Somewhere in that area. Yeah.
Wow.
So, I mean, and listen, there are people, you know, at 10 years on the show, I was on the show for a long time. There's people a lot longer. There's people who did the whole 17 years. People have done well over 100 episodes, you know. No one left that show. You don't leave that show if you get a spot on it.
Were you with him when it ended?
No. No, I was with him about a week and a half before. No, I had good friends that were there.
I was in Chicago, and I woke up, and I checked my phone, and I got a text from my friend Maynard, Maynard Keenan, from Tool. And Maynard is a jiu-jitsu brown belt and really loves jiu-jitsu, and he texted me. He said, so much for the Maynard versus Anthony Bourdain celebrity jiu-jitsu match. And that's the whole text. And, you know, just sunk a pit in my stomach. And I just picked up my phone. I went into Google and I looked it up and I saw it. I'm just like, oh, fuck. I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. You know, I started crying. I think I called my wife. I think I called Maynard. I texted him. I called my wife. Called a few friends. You know, just like, you know, just couldn't believe. You know, when someone's just not there anymore. I didn't get to see him a lot, but I was just a. Just appreciated the fuck out of that dude, you know? Like, I don't want to do anybody's TV show. But when I got a call from him, I was like, fuck yeah. What are we going to do? We're going to shoot pheasants and hunt and camp? And we're going to cook by the campfire? Fuck, I'm in, dude. Yeah. You know? I'm in. I just really appreciated him as a genuine, unique person. Like, he's a genuine, rare person. And, you know, that's what I got out of being able to spend some time with him and being able to talk to him and pick his brain. And he did my podcast once, and we always planned on doing it again, which we never got around to it because we both have ridiculous schedules. But just I would think about things differently because of him. Like, I would sometimes, like, hold things to his standards and. He like legitimately his appreciation for things and his enthusiasm for things changed the way I look at a lot of aspects of food and culture and even travel, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry, man, and I know he thought very highly of you, and that experience in Montana was fantastic, man.
So fun.
You know, it's been a rough 3 months, and it's still hard for me to really contextualize it and put it together. It feels like, you know, upside down world. Like, there's no, and he was such a, I mean, he was a friend and a collaborator and a, you know, but also just such an icon to me, you know, that it's almost like, you know, it's almost like the sun disappears, you know, or something. Yeah. It's something that is so just inherently
part of life
there and dependable and, you know. I mean, it's been, it's hard to describe how profound that's been.
This episode is brought to you by MeUndies. For most of the year, fancy underwear technology sounds unnecessary. Breathable, quick dry, moisture wicking, anti-odor. It's a bit overkill, right? But then summer hits and the heat comes. Suddenly, all that sounds pretty damn essential. Be prepared for summer like me with MeUndies. So far, I love the items that I've gotten from them. They're all soft, comfortable, and flattering. I recommend it hands down. And don't worry, MeUndies has a cut for every guy with over 10 different styles, ranging from boxer briefs to jock straps to the new and improved ball caddy. Plus, they come in over 100 different colors and prints, ranging from black to all over sharks. No matter what pair you get, it'll have MeUndies' signature super soft micro-modal fabric. It is amazing. So everything is breathable, stretchy, and oh so comfy. They also offer some of the most summer-proof fabric. So breathe. It's perfect for working out or just keeping you cool on those really hot days. And if you're not happy with your first pair of underwear, it's on MeUndies. Summer is coming. Be prepared with my favorite underwear, MeUndies. Comfort for the outside in. Get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/Rogan. That's MeUndies.com/Rogan. Tap the banner to learn more. This episode is brought to you by SimpliSafe. Springtime is all about freshness. You got fresh air, fresh starts, freshly cleaned homes. And as you're getting your home in order, it might be a good time to take a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security. I think they're one of the best options out there, and so do a lot of others. SimpliSafe is loved by customers and experts alike. It was even named Best Home Security Systems of 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. And here's why I think you'll like it. The system blankets your whole home in protection. That includes advanced sensors and cameras to help detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, with 24/7 professional monitoring, you can rest easy knowing you'll get a fast emergency response when you need it most. Monitoring agents can even help stop crime in real time. SimpliSafe has given many people a real peace of mind. I want you to have it too. So try it out risk-free with no contract and a 60-day money-back guarantee. Get 20% off your system today when you sign up for Fast Protect Monitoring at simplisafe.com/JRE. That's simplisafe.com/JRE. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
I remember when he got into jiu-jitsu, I got psyched because I'm like, we got more to talk about now. Like I could actually show him some shit. You know, and he was always asking about things, you know. He's really into things. Remember when we were in Montana, we were rolling around on the dirt.
I know. I
showing him stuff, him and Josh. I was like when you're in here, like here's what you can do. You can get and he's like, "Oh, yeah." He's like he was so wide-eyed, you know. I think it was before he even got his blue belt or maybe it was like around blue belt. So he was super, super jacked about it, and he was doing it every day. I remember when we were filming, we were outside of Billings. Is that where we were? Where were we?
Yeah, well, where the hunt was.
Yeah,
The hunt. We were in like up in central Montana, you know. Right. So we kind of started in Billings, but we headed up towards central Montana.
He was training so often, and even on the road, that he traveled to a club. There was just a jiu-jitsu club in Bozeman.
Yeah,
and he found some guys, and he was rolling with these guys in Bozeman.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely.
And I was like, damn, you're doing it every day?
Well, that was
every
day. For a long time on the show, that was a mandate. We find the local, you know, the local clubs and make sure that he had a place to roll.
He texted me from some European bloc country. He said he was shitting bone chips because he worked out with some old school Carlson Gracie guys that they don't believe in rolling light. And it's all top game and smashing you. And he's like, I'm shitting bone chips. But I admired that a guy could be 58 years old and decide, I'm going to learn jiu-jitsu and I'm going to be obsessed with it. And then he became addicted to it, which, you know, jiu-jitsu is a very beneficial thing to be addicted to, but it is absolutely an addiction. I've come back from injuries where I definitely shouldn't have been training yet, and I just wrap my arm up and just fucking get in there. People get super, super addicted to it, and he got addicted to it, just like he's been addicted to many things. He jumped right into the jiu-jitsu experience.
Yeah, man. I'm glad he did. It was clearly, like, really good for him to us. I mean, I know very little about jiu-jitsu. I know what I know from Tony, you know,
basically. He got so slim.
Yeah.
He lost all that weight. All of a sudden he had a six pack.
Stopped smoking.
Yeah.
You know, those were big things, man. And he looked great. He got off statins.
Yeah. He's no longer on any sort of medication. Yeah. He lost all that weight.
Yeah.
Cut all the carbs out. Yeah. He was just eating
just protein.
Crazy, man. Yeah. He looked so good.
He did look good. He did look good. And also just, the whole thing was kind of indicative of the way he was. I mean, he did things so passionately,
yeah.
You know, whether it was travel and the world and soaking up all these experiences or jiu-jitsu or whatever. If he was into something, if something caught his attention, he was just so aggressive about knowledge, learning what he could, pulling everything out of it that he could.
It's just crazy to see someone do something that's that physically demanding
at
58 with no background in athletics at all.
Yeah.
Like you could see when he was like, even when he was doing things, like when he went to Kurt Osiander's place and was rolling around, like he doesn't have a background in that, but he's just pushing himself to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think that was true with everything, you know? I mean, if it was something that was interesting to him, he just went.
Yeah.
You know?
He loved it, man. It was crazy. And I said, I remember texting him going, like, how deep are you getting into it? He goes, real fucking deep. and he goes, I'm getting tapped out every day. But he goes, I'm giving guys half my age a real struggle. And he goes, and I'm loving it.
Yeah. And he talked about that a lot. I mean, I think he talked about like the failure as much as anything mm-hmm. else. And he loved that. Man,
yeah.
Going in and, you know.
Getting smashed.
Yeah. But. You know, again, to his credit, you know,
we'd
show up in these places, you know, Bozeman, Montana, man, or Butte, you know, I mean, geez, I think he rolled in Butte, you know, Butte's a hard hitting town, man. And listen, I love Butte.
I love Butte too.
Much respect to anyone from Butte, but man, that's a hard hitting town, you know, and he'd roll into these
real cowboys
these places. Yeah. You know. And get the shit kicked out of him and show up on set all, you know, sore and bruised and, oh, man, you know, and then just jump into that.
It's just different for a guy who's 58. I mean, you got a guy who does it at 20. I admire anybody who does jiu-jitsu because it's a real humbling, ego-dissolving experience in a lot of ways because it makes you realize, like, all your illusions of how well you can defend yourself, they go out the window when someone just chokes you easily. And you're like, oh, great. I'm just a bitch wandering around, running around this life thinking I'm a man. But the fact that he did it at 58 just showed what kind of a unusual dude he was.
Yeah, but what you just talked about there, I mean, what you're talking about with like the ego diminishing aspect of it. Again, I think that was something that he took great pleasure in.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if you look at the way he went through the world, one of the things that, you know, I appreciated right off the bat and one of the things that kept me around as long as I stayed around, you know, the fact that for Tony, I think that he was constantly trying to dismantle that persona, you know, to say like, I'm not the focal point of this scene
or
what we're interested in here, what I'm interested in talking about is out there. That's the cameras pointed away from me. You know,
right.
He was kind of a clearinghouse for all that information, and he was the root of the show, and it was his journey. But, you know, ultimately, you know, what was refreshing is he wasn't like working with some celebrity or host that was completely consumed by their own ego and their own, you know, brand and how they were presented to the world.
That's so disgusting, right?
You know? Yeah, dude, but it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. Yeah, he was very self-deprecating, and he had reverence for real artists and real masters. And
that total reverence. Yeah,
it came across. It came across. Yeah. I texted him about some guy. There was a photo of a restaurant. And I'm sure it's still on my phone. Some dude who's like a real famous guy who's like some big-time chef character. And I was eating in this restaurant. And so I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? I guess it seems like it's a big deal. And so I texted him the photo of this cat right here.
Yeah.
Do you know who that guy is? What's that guy's name? So I said, who is that guy? It says, Marco Pierre White, made Ramsay cry like a bitch, all-time original rock star chef, genius, madman.
The original punk.
But that kind of text, like that's a Tony Bourdain text.
Oh, man.
Like that's what that text shows that reverence for the masters.
Oh, yeah.
You know? I mean, even the way he phrases it, you know? Made him cry like a bitch. All-time original rock star chef. Genius. Madman.
You know, and that's the way. I mean, what worked about that is he had an instant ability to sniff through the bullshit. You know. So, you know, there's all kinds of famous people, celebrities, and, you know, well-accomplished people that he met that he didn't feel that way right. about, you know? He would cut through that shit instantly. But if you were on his radar in that way, you know, it's like total commitment to what you do.
You were in or you're out of the Anthony Bourdain club.
Exactly. Dude, you want to be in, man.
I know,
that list of people is like, that's a cool list to be on.
Yeah. Well, I just remember hanging out with him. You know, like it was one of those guys. He was one of the ones that I met that I was like pretty starstruck, like right away.
Yeah.
I said something really stupid, like, my wife says you're my boyfriend. Because I watch his show all the time.
Yeah.
She would just joke around, oh, you watch your boyfriend on TV?
Yeah.
I'm like, he's great. This guy's great. Stop. Leave him alone. But, when we were in Montana, that's when I realized, I always knew how hard he went. But when I was blasted out of my mind, and he was like, where's that bottle?
Yeah. Where's
those joints? And I was like, Jesus, man.
Yeah.
I can't even, I'm hanging on to the earth here.
Yeah, well, that was a late night, man.
Yeah.
In all fairness, not every night was quite like that. You know, but that, we had a lot of fun that night for sure.
It was real fun. Yeah. And a really interesting, thoughtful dialogue around the campfire with Lan Towney from Backwoods Country Hunters and Anglers and all these the other guys that were with us. Or, you know, these guys who, it was good to get a different perspective on what going out and getting your own wild food is like.
Yeah.
You know, and then having him cook it there, and it was delicious.
Yeah, it was awesome. And but also being able to put those ideas on like a major network in prime time is pretty rare, man, you know?
Yeah, kudos to CNN for having the cojones to put together that kind of a show and it on, you know?
Yeah, big time, man. What can I say? It's the best creative partners you could ask for in terms of that, you know?
You really enjoyed it that much. Risks. Yeah.
Yeah. What's not that was the dream job. You do what I do, you know, you are interested in making documentary television, you know. That's it, man. That's the
How did it wind up at CNN? Were there some other options? Because I know he had a giant problem with the Travel Channel because I know he had told me that they fucked him over and did some Cadillac ad. And
Yeah. I know he was really pissed about the Cadillac ad.
What was that about?
I don't really know a lot of the details of the whole story.
Right.
I don't know what other deals were on the table besides CNN. But it's safe to say that I think the relationship with Travel Channel was toxic before that. You know, I mean,
Travel Channel's a religious-owned place. At least was. I don't know if still is. I think the original people that owned it, because my friend Bert Kreischer has a show over there, or had a show over there, a couple shows. Bert the Conqueror, and what was his other show? Hurt Bert. Yeah, I was like, Jesus, crazy asshole. But, you know, Bert had issues with that too. Like when he would be on the show, if we'd all be hanging out together, if he wanted to smoke pot, he had to make sure that Jamie turned the camera away from him.
Oh, yeah.
Because they couldn't see him smoke pot.
Oh, no, couldn't. Yeah, for sure. You know, but, I don't have any, like, inside information. So this is purely, like, my outside perspective. I don't do the deals and I don't, deal in that stuff. I make the shows, you know. But, you know, I saw a network that was more interested in making, like, you know, shows about sandcastles, you know.
Yeah.
And ghosts. You know, then
that's why they had a bunch of ghost shows.
A lot of ghost shows.
Yeah, the ghost shows are fucking popular.
Yeah, they're really popular, man.
So stupid.
You know,
they're the dumbest fucking shows on television, and there's like 100 of them. But the thing is, if you're watching, everybody's scared of ghosts. So if you're watching, and it's like people, and they're in the basement, and they have night vision on, and they pretend they see something, you're like, what are they seeing? Is there a fucking real ghost? Cuts to commercial, and then all of a sudden you're hooked, and
it's
watch
a hook,
Tide
man.
Commercial.
It's a hook after hook after hook. Yeah.
It is the craziest, weirdest thing. It's one of the weirder things on television.
I just
these goddamn
can't imagine
ghost
having
shows.
To shoot those shows.
Oh,
my
could you imagine trying to make them interesting?
Stumbling around some fucking old house, like with night vision, you know, trying to.
Is that a fear now? I mean, look, you went from Meat Eater, which is an amazing show, and Parts Unknown and No Reservations, and so you got these three amazing shows, and they put you on a ghost show.
No, that's not a fear of mine. Listen, that might be a nightmare. That might be like something I dream about and wake up in a
ghost.
You know, sweating through my sheets. You know, but No, man, I still work for 0.0, you know.
Hi, Morgan Fallon. It's Mike from Finding Bigfoot. Listen, I don't know if we're coming back for season 1000.
Yeah, exactly.
And,
right.
We're going to find him this year.
Yeah.
Please come aboard. We love what you did with Tony Bourdain, and we think you could do that with Bobo.
You know, but here's the thing, they don't want that. They don't want cinematography, right, and art, you know. They want some kid producer, director, yeah, slash cinematographer that they can, you know, they don't want what we do.
They want fake,
you know,
Bigfoot noises.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm still, like I said, I'm still with 0.0, Tony's long-time production company. We do awesome work. We got a ton of awesome stuff lined up. You know, we'll be okay, man. But
are you going to do more stuff with Steve at Meat Eater?
I'll go out with Steve anytime he calls. I just need a little more advance warning these days. I think, right, they called me last week to see if I wanted to do an elk hunt.
Now, if you do that, would you try to get in shape first, like heavy duty?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because the last time I went out with him, I got my ass kicked.
It's fucking rough.
Are you kidding, man? Dude, he's got I mean, talk about a guy with, like, you know, he has no empathy whatsoever for the people he's with who maybe can't keep up with him. No. Man, when you're in the, it's like, if you can't make that hike, you're just, yeah, not making that hike, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, he weighs 110 pounds, and he can walk for days.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's, yeah, been doing this since he was a baby.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, man. I went – the last time I went out with him was, I guess, 2 years ago. I went up to Alaska and did the blacktail hunt. But we actually had nice weather, which was kind of unbelievable, because I know you've been up there when it's like – you know, 10 days of rain coming in sideways.
Rough. Yeah, we had to leave early last time I was there because a storm was coming and we had to make a decision.
It's a storm coming every time we get up there.
We weren't going to be able to get out. It was a possibility.
Right, and exactly.
But part of me was like, even though we're rain-soaked, I want to hunt the last 6 hours.
Yeah.
Because if I stay the last day, never know. That might be the – I mean, that's so many times that's when you hook up with an animal.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in my experience up there –
hook up with an animal sounds like the wrong thing to say. Like, really, really wrong.
You can hook up with an animal and catch a can.
Yeah.
No, man, but, you know, like, it was – that's exactly the way it was. You go up there and you'd be in, you know, 6 days of rain, but all of a sudden, you know, the fog would clear and there's some, you know – yeah, blacktail standing, yeah, right there looking at you, you know.
A lot of bear up there too.
Yeah, tons of bear. No, but he, you know, I got my ass whooped last time I went up there. First time I went up there, I was still in shape, you know. I was younger.
Yeah.
And I did pretty well.
Well, you were doing it all the time. You have to do, yeah, it all the time.
You
the,
have to
the
do
hiking
it all the time.
Thing is something, I mean, you're basically building up this endurance in your legs that you only get from hiking.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Hiking endurance is no joke. It seems like it's a joke because if you hike for like 5 feet, it seems like nothing. You climb a small hill, you're like, I could do this all day. You think you could do it all day. You do that for 20 minutes, you'd start heaving, you'd be drenched in sweat, you'd want to take your jacket off, and then you realize, like, oh my God, I have to do this for 8 more hours?
8 more days.
Yeah, and then the morning, yeah, you go, and, yeah, and if your immune system is at all taxed, it's going to crash hard, you might get sick.
Yeah, man. No, you can, like you said, you can't train for it. You can't train for that kind of backcountry stuff. You can, right, go out and, you know, run up and down the Stairmaster or whatever, but
that doesn't really
it doesn't
do it.
Train all like those little muscles, mm-hmm, that you use to constantly stabilize, right, yourself, you know?
Yeah. Stairmaster will help a little.
What's that?
Stairmaster will help a little, but what really helps
the major muscle groups,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Running hills helped me a lot.
Yeah.
Just because it's so much harder than hiking. You just run them, you could do it easier. It makes hiking easier. Hiking with weighted packs on, too. Did you ever do that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what we did.
But, I mean, just, you know, like for training.
Oh,
purposes.
Just for training? Yeah, yeah, I would. On the Stairmaster, actually. I'm, mm-hmm, here I am. I'm dissing the Stairmaster with that.
Stairmaster's
exactly
good.
What I was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'd put weights in my pack and go in the Stairmaster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And boots, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Weird,
right,
boots on the,
yeah,
Stairmaster.
Did they let you do that at the gym or they look at you weird?
Well, everyone looks at you weird. I mean, my God, if you even talk about hunting in Los Angeles, they look at you weird, man.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah.
Like,
what's wrong,
know,
with you?
What the fuck that guy got, yeah, camo on for? I mean, yeah, dude, Jesus Christ, dude. You know?
Did you wear camo at the gym?
I feel like I may have had some camo aspect to my pack. Yeah.
Of course.
But,
yeah.
Bloodstains. You know, it's interesting, though, because I think back on those times and, like, you know, like while we're talking about, like, all the shitty weather and all that stuff. And I just think back to that. The first time I went out with Steve, him saying, like, yeah, dude, but you won't, you know, you never tell stories about the good days, right. You know? And I got to say, to his credit, that's been absolutely true. It's like those shitty days, freezing cold, you know, getting out of your sleeping bag in the morning and putting on wet clothes, cold, wet clothes to go, you know, to go out and hunt all day, you know. I look back on that with a great degree of fondness. And I also have to say, it made me a lot more of a person than I was before, you know.
Toughens you up.
It toughened me up. It opened me up to the idea of – it opened me up to accepting, you know, possibilities for myself that I had never thought of before. Mm. You know, like
– your capabilities.
Your capabilities, you know, that we like – we all have that somewhere back down in the brainstem, this idea, this ability to just go out in the woods and, you know, hunt something and eat it.
Right.
You know, and up until that point, I had never done that. I'd done some hiking and some camping. I was always on like trails and they're all nicely marked and stuff like that. The idea of stepping out of the back door of Steve's cabin and just into the woods at that time for me when I first did it, that was completely new. I was like, well, you can just walk into the woods? Like, what do you mean, man?
Where are you going?
Like, where do we go? Right. You know, and then to do it and to have it be successful and to bring that animal back and to sit around and to eat it and all that stuff, that was a real huge aha moment for me, you know, personally and professionally. Like, oh, we can do shit that we used to do, you know, 10,000 years ago.
Well, it was big for me, too. I remember saying that on the show, like, when Steve was asking me and Brian on the first hunt, which just by sheer luck, we were both successful on the first hunt.
Yeah.
And Steve was like, do you think you're going to do it again? And I said, fuck yeah, I'm doing this forever. Like, I knew it.
Yeah.
And he goes, when did you know? I said, the moment that deer dropped.
Yeah.
The moment the deer dropped, I'm like, okay, I'm doing this forever.
Yeah.
This is how I'm getting my meat now. I'm going to do this.
Yeah, man. I don't know. There's so many just like really glib interpretations of like the motivation behind hunting, you know. That's like cruelty and bloodlust and all, it's like,
because in its worst cases that's true.
Yeah, and because I do think that hunting shows for years, that's a lot of what they put forward was like kind of machismo and guys shooting, you know, black bears over, you know, donut barrels, you know, for all the wrong reasons, you know.
But at least we think of that as something that people, or at least I do, think of that as something that people eat for food. When you think about Cecil the lion, like kind of shit really sours people on the idea of hunting, because there's no justification for the average person for shooting a lion. I mean, you'd have to do decades of education about conservation and the importance of the money that goes for the hunt. And then they still don't get it because they're like, why would you want to shoot a lion? And that's the good question.
Right.
The good question is, why would you want to shoot a lion?
But, I would say it's a good question for me, too. I definitely have limits. You know, as much as I went around with Steve, I have limits on what I would personally choose to do. And I got to say, the Africa stuff, for me, man, it's not interesting to me, you know.
The only thing that's interesting to me in Africa would be to hunt something that I would eat. So like if they have antelope in Africa, I would love to hunt an antelope.
They got a lot of those.
Yeah, hunt an antelope and cook it and eat it.
Yeah.
That to me makes sense. There's no way I want to shoot a hippo or anything else. Even if people do eat hippos, and I understand they do, okay, good luck.
Yeah.
I don't want to have nothing to do with any of that.
No, me neither.
But game animals that are delicious, nilgai, things like that, that people have eaten forever and that they hunt just like they hunt elk or deer here, that to me makes sense. It would be just an adventure to go to Africa. But Africa's so fucking scary. It's so sketchy.
I love Africa. And I became like, I kind of took all the Africa shows I could on Parts Unknown.
Really?
It's the most wonderful place. First of all, I think that there's a lot of misperception when it comes. I've never had a negative experience there. I had one experience that was kind of quasi threatening. You know,
and quasi?
We had a crowd kind of turn on us and throw rocks at us as we were driving away. That's the one experience of like hundreds of experiences.
What was that about?
Well, we're in Goma in the DRC, you know, and it's just a really, really chaotic place. The place has been run over by civil wars for decades. People are in serious desperation. But I think worse than any of that, there's a huge culture of of nonprofit organizations and stuff there. So I think they're used to kind of white folks coming in with this very patronizing kind of view. And then we're down there with cameras filming them. And then all of a sudden they realize that we're not paying anyone for this, you know? And I think, you know, there's a tendency from people to feel like, well, you're here taking something from us. You know, you're clearly making more money than any of us will ever, you know, be able to make. And what the fuck do we get for it? You know, and I can understand that point of view.
And how did it turn into them throwing rocks at you guys?
No, again, they realized that we weren't going to be paying for any of this. You know, our security team was like, hey, guys, time to get in the car. As soon as you get in the car and you're leaving, it's like, oh, these fucking assholes, man. They just came down here, got all their footage, and they're going to pack up and go back to their nice hotel, you know. But that's the one experience, man. Like, a lot of experiences there. You know, for the most part, I found people there to be, like, incredibly gracious, you know. I found it to be one of the most hopeful places, honestly. My day-to-day experiences in Africa, I saw people who were working their asses off on a grassroots level. Some of the most, some of the most like dynamic grassroots capitalism that I've ever seen. I mean, people who will literally find any way to scrape out an existence and a living. You know, this is not a lazy culture. This is a culture that will fight through anything. You know, go to Lagos, and Lagos is one of the most dynamic cities I've ever been in. This is constantly moving. Constantly people trying to make money, constantly people trying to find a niche, you know, in a city of 20 million people, you know. So I find a lot of beauty in just like raw human endeavor there. And I think that, you know, if they can clear some of the like obvious stumbling blocks that they have in terms of corruption, in terms of, you know, foreign pressure, in terms of, you know, manipulation of markets, there's tremendous promise there. I mean, like, just in terms of the internet and technology sector in Africa is like absolutely booming. You know, you have kids that come in from the villages on the streets of Lagos who can take your computer apart and rebuild it by hand, you know, self-taught. And all of that potential is there to be tapped. You know, and they're starting to, you know, so I guess I just find it a hopeful place.
That's amazing that you only had one bad experience.
Only one. But I can say that about traveling the world kind of in general. I mean, we've been in a number of, you know, relatively hot zones. I mean, we never did active conflict because we don't, you know, make that kind of show. But, you know, being in places like Gaza or the DRC or, you know, I can count on one hand and, you know, in many, many years of doing this, you know, the number of times that I actually felt threatened by someone, you know. I've found that the most likely scenario is you're going to get, like, accosted by a sandwich, you know, or someone trying to, you know, introduce you to their kids, you know, or take a selfie with you. And that's the world that I know. I don't really understand the world that we see, you know, on TV here, man, because that's not my experience, you know.
Right.
You know, a lot of good people. And again, getting back to Tony, I think that, you know, that's the legacy, right? I think that he really showed people that.
That is a problem with our view of the world, is that if it doesn't look scary, they're not going to show it to you.
No.
Because totally if it's not dangerous, I mean, other than his show, what else are you seeing on CNN where they're in Africa where it's a good thing? What else are you seeing where people are in Egypt where it's a good thing? What else are you seeing where people are interacting with people on the street and there's not some sort of a murder story or a rape story or something awful?
Yeah. I mean, I think you're starting to see it a little bit, but mostly you're seeing it in, like, you know, on like CNN's Africa, you know, network or, you know, there you're starting to see them covering stories about entrepreneurs.
Right.
You know, positive aspects, you know, building economies.
But it's a real problem in our view of the world for people that don't travel.
Well, listen, Africa just simply doesn't make news in the United States. I mean, and it takes a genocide, you know.
Well, all I've been hearing about Africa lately is what's going on with white farmers in South Africa, which is
yeah.
It's very scary stuff where people are encouraging people to attack white farmers. You know, and there's a whole lot of socio-political and economic shit that goes on with that I'm not even going to pretend I understand. But that's what you hear about. You don't hear about good things. You hear about how many farmers have been murdered in their homes.
Well, that's a shame, man, because, you know, you go there and most of what I find going on there is positive. You know, listen, there's a lot of pain. There's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of bad shit that happens there, too, obviously. I'm not going to deny that. You know, but, you know, we don't hear the good stuff.
Did you have a good, did you have like a place where you enjoyed traveling to the most?
I don't think really because, to me, this is another kind of like real lesson of the show. You know, I think we got to a place where we were finding something kind of everywhere, you know, there are some places that I didn't enjoy as much, you know, but I think most places we found something that was like, oh, this is awesome, you know.
Where was the one place where you're like, eh, I'm not going back here again?
I don't want to say.
Okay. Keep it positive, people. Keep it positive.
Let's just say it's a highly militarized state with deep problems, okay. You know, and deep divides and on both sides.
Yeah, okay.
You know. And a lot of beautiful people on both sides, but, you know. But I think, you know, I mean, this was something we, like, would encounter a lot as we kind of progress in the show. Is this, you know, I mean, my dad would say it to me all the time. He's like, well, where are you guys going to go now? You know, we've been everywhere. It's just like, yeah, but I think we started to learn that you could, like, really point the camera kind of anywhere. And I think a big one for me was, like, doing this West Virginia show last year. Which is a place that had always been, like, really close to my heart. Like, I grew up there when I was a kid. You know, it's a place that has been, I think, like, deeply misrepresented. Again, another place that's been deeply misrepresented in the media. You know, but, you know, we got, like, I got into town on the scout there, and it's like, there's no restaurant, you know. It's not just that there's no restaurant, like, in the town. There's, like, two restaurants in the county. You know, and I remember having this moment of like, can we do this? Does this work? Like, will Tony respond to this and we make a show here? And within 2 days, he was like, big, you know, very deeply heartfelt statements about the place, really loved it, you know. And it was kind of another aha moment. You're like, oh, yeah, of course. Because there's something everywhere. The human story is everywhere, and you right. can dig into it wherever you go. The fundamentals of that don't change. And I think that, you know, what he did was so cleanly and clearly and so free of bullshit cut to the core of those very fundamental kind of human stories, you know. And anyways, it worked well. We won an Emmy two nights ago for it. So,
yeah. Posthumous Emmys are always odd, right?
Yeah, that was a rough night. Yeah.
When he would get the rough cut, would it be length of the actual show, and then he would add narration to it? Did he have any say in the editing process?
Huge. I mean, so I think that's something important too about who he was. You know, I mean, like everyone calls him a chef. He wasn't a chef. Like he was a producer. He was a television producer.
Right.
You know, He would pick the locations. He would pick the subject matter for the most part. You know, there were a couple. Like,
how did you guys work it out? Like, say if you were going to go to Puerto Rico or something like that, how would you make the decisions? How would you decide where to go and why?
Okay. Well, I'll take you through the whole process.
Okay, yeah.
So Tony would come up with a list of places that he was interested in going, and maybe we would throw a couple in, like I mentioned the West Virginia show, you know. You'd be like, but this is my list, right? And then he'd write like a brief on each one. I'm interested in X, you know, like I'm interested in Singapore. It's Disneyland with the death penalty, right? And you're like, okay, so there's kind of a basic operating thesis, right? We can kind of like go in and look at this place from this perspective. And some of them didn't. The Lagos episode, for example, you'd just be like, we haven't been to Nigeria. Let's go to Nigeria, you know? And then so we would start doing research on what that was, just big kind of, you know, 30,000 foot macro, you know, what is this environment like? What are the interesting things? What are the stories that have been told about this place? And how can we look at it from a different angle? So like the Nigeria one, we kind of focused in on, like I said, you know, grassroots capitalism, DIY entrepreneurship, you know, street level, you know, the street level kind of dynamics of the economy, you know, and that became like we could see ways to kind of make a beautiful, like, human story out of those elements. So I'd end up putting down to him probably in like a 2 or 3 page thing, like, here are my ideas, you know, here's what I found based on what you were interested in. Here's some other things I found. This is the way we'd kind of like to go about it. And he'd either be like, yeah or no, you know. And from that point, we'd just get heavy into research, write a treatment, you know, and break that story into like 6 acts, right? And then look for scenes to kind of fill and articulate that story. So scenes like, you know, I have this great economist. I know we're going to need an economist at some point, but we got to put, you know, economists are kind of boring by nature. So we got to put him somewhere more dynamic where there's this really interesting computer market that has a lot of energy. So let's put the economists there. They can walk around. There's a great restaurant in the corner there. So like, here's some elements we can put together. That's a scene in a act of the show. So you put all that stuff together in treatment form, send it to Tony. Usually minimal notes from him, you know. And then we'd go out, scout, shoot the show, you know.
How weird is it shooting in a restaurant with camera people standing over the table?
I think we got really good at not taking over the environment, you know? So I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. Because
how do you do it?
How, like, do we do
say
it?
If you and I are having a conversation at dinner and we're being filmed,
right?
Would they be as close as Jamie is right there?
The cameras?
Yeah.
Closer than that.
We're right on top of you.
Yeah, they're pretty close. But, you know.
And they're standing.
Yeah. But we wouldn't use, like, there were rules to that, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, we're a documentary show. We can't just go in and just, like, completely take over some place or take over some village or scare the shit out of local people or, you know what I mean? Like, we got to go in with some deftness, you know? So we would go in early and we would light so that the characters, Tony, aren't really seeing us screw around with lighting, stuff mm-hmm. like that. That's all kind of in place.
This episode is brought to you by Hostage Tape. First of all, what a great name. This is a product that I use, and I started using long before it was an ad. Your sleep game is about to get a whole lot better, kids, because I want to introduce you to Hostage Tape. Put simply, it is tape for your mouth. But you're probably wondering why you should even need that. Well, if you're a mouth breather, if you snore a lot, or if you suffer from sleep apnea, this could make a big difference. This mouth tape can reduce or eliminate snoring and apnea, and at the same time, it'll help filter the air going to your lungs, increase your oxygen uptake, and improve circulation, which will make you feel more energized. It has tons of other benefits, too, like it helps with bad breath, dry mouth, and, of course, better sleep. For you and your partner, don't let bad sleep hold you hostage. Shut your fucking mouth with Hostage Tape. Buy it today and get a special buy two, get one free offer. That's a 90-day supply. Just visit HostageTape.com/Rogan. That's HostageTape.com/Rogan.
Put the cameras in there, no sound guy, no big booms, right. Sit the rest of the crew down.
Are they wearing wireless mics?
Yeah, exactly. And then fill in local people in the rest of the restaurant. Make sure that there are people who actually go to that restaurant in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. Make sure that it feels like alive, not like full of, you know, extras like miming dialogue.
And are they carrying large cameras? Like, how big are the cameras they're carrying?
They're big cameras.
Like regular big old production cameras, heavy on the shoulders.
Yeah.
Like you guys would use a meat eater.
Yeah. You know, but again, you know, it's two guys standing there with cameras that have been traveling, at least from Tony's perspective, have been traveling with Tony for a long time, you know? Right. It's just like having two more, you know, friends at the meal.
Right.
In terms of with the sidekicks, you know, I think we learned early on that, like, You gotta go up. You gotta introduce yourself. You gotta smile. You gotta laugh. You gotta be able to be self-deprecating. Make them feel comfortable, like you're there to ask them questions, not right. to tell them who they are, you know? And I don't know, man. I just say we traveled all over the place. A lot of people had never been on camera before. It largely worked, you know? So we must have been doing something right.
Was there ever a time you were in a restaurant and people were pissed off that there was people standing there with cameras filming a table?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, that's pretty easy. You know, someone gets pissed off and they wave you off. And just, okay, cool. Sorry. You know, no worries. You know, it never really escalated, you know, at least with me. Never escalated.
You had a view of the world by doing that show and traveling the way you did that is less than 1% of the population is ever going to experience. Probably less than 1% of 1%.
Yeah, I would say for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be an incredibly enriching journey for you.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, hugely. There's, I mean, it's, I don't know. It's very simple. There's before and there's after. And it's two different people, really.
Because you know? Just all the data you had to take in, the view of the world changes. It gets bigger. It becomes a much bigger place.
It does. That's what's, you know, that's exactly right. And that's what's really interesting. I tell people this too. They'd be like, oh, well, you know, you've been all these places. And it's, you know, like, yeah, but the world doesn't work like that. It's not like the more places you go, the smaller the world feels. The more places you go, the bigger the world feels. It just right. feels bigger and bigger and bigger because you realize, like, there's, you know,
people
there's
everywhere.
This country, there's this county in this country, there's this town in this county, there's this street, there's all these other streets, there's all these other people.
Yeah.
You know, our shows were just a sliver of a place, a tiny little sliver, you know? You can go into Lagos. We'd go back to Lagos and make 10 more shows, each one of them completely unique and individual, you know? The world's a big place, a lot of shit going on, you know?
Yeah. Now, they're going to keep airing these shows, right? I mean, how long are they going to do this for? They have how many did they have all told? How many they did 5 seasons?
5 seasons, 18. I mean, I guess we're getting near 100 shows, you know. I've never counted. I don't really know. A lot of shows, though. Yeah, they'll keep airing.
I have it on my DVR, so they'll occasionally run these marathons and then I'll go to my DVR and there's like 20 new shows.
Yeah.
You know, and I watched a few of them the other night. The first time I watched it in a while, I posted a thing on Instagram, too, about it because I was real reluctant to watch it after he died. But then I went on a bender. And I binged, watched like 3 of them in a night. I was like, God damn, what a good show it was.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good, man.
You guys nailed it.
Yeah.
And you should be really proud.
Thanks, man. Yeah, and I'm actually still working on one right now, which is maybe the weirdest experience, you know. Mm. You were asking about process before, you know. After we'd shoot it, that's when Tony really came in, you
What
know?
Do you do if he's not there for narration?
Well, that's the thing.
Who narrates it?
You know, I'm not going to replace Tony.
So no narration?
No.
Yeah.
No. I mean, we have our sidekicks talking to him. We have his dialogue in the field, you know, but who's going to step in and do that voice?
No one, and
how offensive would it be if we did that?
Have to be someone who is so close to him that it didn't freak everybody out. It'd have to be someone who was on the show 1,000 times and was just there with him always.
Yeah.
That person doesn't really exist.
It doesn't. Yeah. There's no voice there.
When you would give him a rough cut, say if you, like I said, a show on Puerto Rico or what have you. So he would take that, he would watch it, and then he would start writing.
Exactly. So getting back to process, I'd send him an act, right, once it was in rough cut form, and then you get his notes back. That was always kind of a terrifying moment too, because you're like, dude, you've worked on this thing a lot.
Right.
And you send it off to him, he can go one way or another, man.
Right.
I got gutted a few times, man. But I got a couple that were like out fucking standing, you know, and that's all the notes he had.
Mm.
But you would you'd send him basically scratch writing. So you'd say like, here's what we're thinking, you know, is this kind of idea goes here, this kind of idea goes here. And then he would actually write it, you know, and you get that writing back.
How long would it take for him to do something like that?
Oh, he ripped that shit out, man.
Yeah.
He was fast. And that's the thing, too. I never, you know, there was never an email or a text that he didn't get back to you. He was no slouch, man. He was sharp. He was on it. He'd get back to you. He'd do the work. You know,
Well, he took pride in that.
Yeah.
He would talk about
a lot
that,
of pride.
Doing the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he did. I mean, there's another, that's another thing that was so delightful about it, you know? It's not like you're having to drag some, you know, carcass along and, you know, prop him up in front of the camera and, you know, he was into it, man. And like, he had total ownership, total control. Awesome, incredible creative ideas, incredible creative power. Like, he was in, you know, and no show was like, nah, fuck it, you know, we can just like kind of slip by on this one. You know, every show was important, and when they, you know, when they weren't working, he was pissed, you know, and great, you know. I think, yeah, the biggest thing that I miss in this process of cutting this Texas show that I'm doing now is not having the pressure of him looking at it and being like, dude, you know, no, man, this right. ain't working. You know, that was a real benefit to us. Yeah.
When did he start smoking again?
It's the weirdest thing, man. I didn't really know he was smoking again. And then the Puglia show came out and I just saw him light up on camera. You know, I was like, oh shit, I guess we're doing really? This again. And then a couple of my shows at the end, he'd start just lighting up on camera. And that was always no go territory. Like in the past, when he was smoking, we would like stop shooting, you know? All of a sudden, he was just lighting up right on camera, and I don't know, it shocked the shit out of me. You know, I kind of looked around the crew like, "What do we do?" Like,
well, I was shocked because he said that when his daughter was born is when he decided to stop smoking, because he realized that, you know, he had something else to live for, and that he, you know, he didn't want to be on some cancer bed,
yeah, with
a fucking iron lung, having his daughter visit him.
Yeah.
So he quit.
Yeah. It was a bummer when he started again. That's, you know.
Did he stop going to jiu-jitsu?
I don't know. I guess it wasn't as frequent during the end, you know, during the last few episodes. We stopped kind of having to find gyms. And we'd offer, you know, and be like, nah, I'm, you know. Cool. So I think the last couple of shows are probably like that for me, where I was like, you want to find a local gym? And be like, no, I'm, you know, I'm good, man.
So was it within the last year or so, or less than a year?
I'd say the last year or so, yeah.
So that's when the smoking started?
I guess maybe a little earlier than that, yeah.
Whew, it's a bummer when you see someone quit and then go back on. That is one of the weirder things of our culture.
Because he got through the really hard part, you know. Mm-hmm. He had a couple of years under his belt, and he looked great, man. He was, you know, really, he was doing really well, yeah, with that.
Yeah. So. Where do you go from here, Mo?
Where do I go from here?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I, you know, I, you know, Tony, I think, gave us, like, tremendous tools to, you know, for how we look at the world and like how we will continue to go on looking at the world. And I don't know exactly what show I'll do, but I know it will continue that kind of ethos, you know. And I feel like I have this very powerful kind of I don't know, like I said, set of tools now that he kind of handed us, you know, that to go on and keep doing, I guess, this work, you know?
Isn't the problem with this work that you need someone like him? You kind of need, like, either a Ranella, who's a very unique person, and in many ways similar. Not self-destructive at all, but really meticulous about his work.
Yeah.
And a very good writer as well. And his narration. Like, one of the things that separates Meat Eater from any other show is that Steve has this eloquent narration.
Yeah, exactly.
That goes through it. And it makes you realize, like, our perception of what it means to be a hunter is based on stereotypes, negative stereotypes. This is the best example. This is a really well-read, brilliant man who has a great passion for the outdoors and for public lands and for wildlife and for consuming wildlife and this adventure of pursuing it and and eating it and cooking it and showing you the art of cooking it. You know, that you wouldn't be able to make Meat Eater with Pigman.
Dude, I can't even talk about Pigman. Fucking guy. The apocalypse?
Yeah.
I mean, come on, dude.
Well, unfortunately, I enjoyed that. for all the wrong reasons. Because, see, there's justification enjoying apocalypse. First of all, because you got Ted Nugent with a machine gun and a helicopter. Okay? And then two, you have this real wild pig epidemic. It's a legitimate epidemic in Texas, and they don't know how to eradicate them.
I get all that. And
putting it on television on a hunting show, it's not really hunting. It's assassinating out of a helicopter, laughing.
It's that part. It's the mentality behind it that, you know, I'm like, listen, I'm not saying don't have fun on a hunt. I've had a lot of fun on hunts, you know. I have a great time on a hunt. I don't know. There's something about, you know,
I know what you're saying. I know exactly what
you're saying. Firing off 1,000 rounds, cackling out of the side of a helicopter. You know?
Laughing when you see pigs do somersaults because you headshotted them sideways helicopter.
You know, I think it's one of the things that I really loved about Steve. You know, like, that I still love about Steve. a really poignant episode on that show for me was when we went up to Alaska and we were hunting black bear, and he decided not to take a shot.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, here's a guy that loves animals as much as he loves hunting animals, as much as he loves conservation of animals, as much as he loves the knowledge and the science behind animals and the natural world, you know. That to me was appealing. Like, that's something I can sink my teeth into and dedicate my efforts towards, you know, furthering and working on. Yeah, it was a crazy show, man.
I mean, I talked to him about it, and his sort of idea of why he didn't do it was so interesting.
Yeah.
He just kind of went with his feelings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
To have a hunting show where you have a bear, which is what you're looking for, lined up in your scope, and you go, I don't want to do it.
I'm not feeling it. And I loved what he said, too, at the time. So he was like, I'm not saying I'm never going to shoot a bear again. I just don't want to shoot a bear today, and I'm not going to. And that was a big moment, man.
That's the words coming out of his mouth. How conflicted must his perception be to realize that, okay, I'm filming a show where I'm actively hunting bears. There's camera people there. Yeah. There's a budget behind it.
Yeah.
Now I have to make a show about my decision to not hunt a bear, and then next week I'm going to go hunt something else. And then the next week I'm going to go hunt something else.
Yeah, but I mean, that, like, his ability to like, admit and kind of understand that the human being is a complex animal with complex emotions.
Right.
And that, you know, this idea of just kind of uniform direction of the human mind is, like, a total fallacy, man.
Mm.
We're all over the fucking place, you know? And, like, I don't know. I really bought in at that moment. If I hadn't before, which I completely kind of had, but I really bought in at that moment. I was like, this is a guy I can always stand behind, you know?
One of my favorite episodes.
It was brave.
It was brave because you realize this is on the Sportsman's Network.
Yeah.
So the Sportsman's Channel, and they have only hunting shows.
Oh, man.
And then he's on a hunting show with, you got all these people that are watching that would kill to be on a hunt like that.
Yeah.
And to have a big old bear in their sights, what they want.
Yeah.
And they're thinking, we're going to see Steve shoot this. Then we're going to see him cook up a bear roast. And we're going to see stewed carrots and onions and potatoes. And this is going to be amazing. And he's going, no, I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, what?
Yeah. And we were really nervous. I remember when the episode came out. We were like, was this? And we had done a few things before. Like, we had failed at a hunt. Like, you know, we had taken shots that missed and the hunt failed. We had gone on a mountain lion hunt where we never even saw a mountain lion. Those were all kind of moments where, like, will this work? Can we put this out in the hunting community? Will they respond to it? And every one of those had kind of, like, hit or worked. And I think people actually appreciate it because of the realism of it, you know? Yeah. That one was like, can you put out a show where there's a perfectly legitimate shot at, you know, I mean, a very high percentage shot at exactly the animal we're going after, and the choice to not take the shot, you know, how are people going to respond? Overwhelmingly, people were like, hey, man, I know exactly how you feel, you know?
Yeah.
It was incredible, you know? It was like, this moment, and I don't mean to bag on anyone else, man, and I don't know that much about hunting shows before. You know, I know that a lot of what I saw I found to be really, really either uninteresting or just fucking stupid, you know. But, you know, I think that it was like this moment where like, oh, my God, like all these, you know, this industry has like missed a big, big part of who the people, you know, that are paying attention here are, you know. You don't have to just go like sell arrowheads, you know. And, you know, cackle hanging out of a helicopter.
Yeah. Well, that's worst case example. But for some hunting people that are like sort of deeply indoctrinated into the world of hunting, they don't mind that show.
No.
They don't mind any of those
Listen,
shows.
Man, no power, more power to them. I'm not trying to tell anyone how to be or what to like or what
to appreciate.
There's
just not a lot of guys like Steve. I mean, do you know Donnie Vincent?
No.
A similar guy.
Yeah.
Similar guy. Really, really smart guy.
Yeah.
And just great reverence for the outdoors and for wildlife. Yeah. And, you know, he does everything self-filmed and sells the,
yeah, that's cool.
the films
yeah.
online. And he's smart. You know, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, cool, man.
But he, you know, Steve, he's sort of changed the perception of hunting for a lot of people that have become fans of his show, the same way that Tony sort of changed the perceptions of
absolutely.
Food and of cooking.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mean, I'm not like Terrence Malick or something, but like, I got a lot to offer, and I got a career. I'm not gonna dedicate my career to these people unless I really, really believe in what they're
right.
doing. And like, those are two cases of people that I like. Really believe in, man,
yeah.
because they were willing to look at an industry or look at something that they loved and say like, well, I have a completely different take on it, you know, and I'm willing to put that out there at whatever
yeah.
cost. And in both cases it worked because they're both super smart, you know, really capable people, you know.
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever met really anyone more capable than Steve in a lot of ways. That guy is he's he's kind of a force of nature, you know.
He's a very unique person,
yeah.
you know. And the amount of stuff that he's able to get done as well, you know, written a bunch of books and constantly doing these shows. And I don't just – the enthusiasm to – I mean, he's not just going to these places and staying in hotels. He's sleeping on the ground outside in these, you know, really fucked up places. And you know about a fog knack, what happened with the bear attack.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, which is just, if anybody doesn't know, there's a two-part series on the Meat Eater podcast about a fog knack, which is an island in Alaska where they have enormous brown bears, and they got charged and attacked by a fucking 11-foot bear, which is just so
yeah.
crazy to think of, and the description of it, and they made this podcast right after the fact, so it's fresh in everyone's mind. It is amazing. It's amazing.
It's an amazing story. It's also amazing it's not the first time he's been charged,
yeah.
and, you know, by a number of different animals. He was run over by a moose.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I will say that, I mean, Steve also is, like, physically one of the toughest people I've ever met. I mean, I watched him set beaver traps one time breaking ice with his bare fist to set beaver traps for hours. You know, put your hand in that water for 2 minutes. You know, just that's someone who does not have trouble, you know, enduring a lot of physical discomfort.
Yeah.
You know, and that was what was kind of exciting about the show, too, is he was really, like, willing to integrate that stuff into the experience, you know. It wasn't like we need to go out, we need the perfect kill shot, we need to set this up, we need to set that. It was kind of like, well, we're just going to go out and we're going to see what happens. We're going to kind of grit our teeth and bear it no matter what, you know, where the journey takes us. And we're just going to document that. That was like super exciting television to make at that time, too. It's like, you know,
I've done five episodes of his show
yeah.
and we struck out on two of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's
yeah.
It used to be they would never air shows like that.
No. I don't know that they aired. I'm sure a lot of people will, you know, be like, yeah, dude, you don't know what you're talking about. But I'm not sure that they aired a lot of failed hunts before we started doing it.
I don't think they did. I don't think it was a popular thing. I mean, it might have been done before, but not to the extent the way Steve did. One of my favorite episodes, he never shot a deer. It was talking about his dad. He was on.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's a great beautiful episode.
I know.
I think that was Alaska as well. Wasn't it?
I don't think it was.
Wasn't it a blacktail hunt? Maybe it wasn't Alaska.
No, I feel like it was a coos deer hunt.
I think you're right.
In Arizona.
And most of the show was him using a spotting scope and binoculars, looking for deer and talking about his relationship with his father.
Yeah.
And there was no music. And whoever edited it and put it together was brilliant.
Yeah.
It was perfect.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, some heavy, heavy duty shit. And it sort of makes you realize, like, oh, this is where you came from. You came from a hard man.
Yeah, big time. Taskmaster.
Yeah.
You know. That was a brilliant episode. It's also, like, I think, you know, one of the things I like so much about that episode, too, is it feels so much like the process of hunting. You know?
Yeah.
It's long hours with people really kind of getting deep into stuff. And that... You know, I did an episode with him, too. It hasn't aired yet, but it was a lot of that. A lot of, like, just talking about life, you know?
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed that part of being out with him, too. Like spending those long hours just sitting glassing hills, like, talking about our families and, you know, plans for the future. You know?
Yeah.
And it was nice, man. I can't tell you how lucky I feel in my career to, like, landed with these folks, you know.
Yeah, that's a great one too, right there. Those two guys.
Yeah.
But like we were saying, it's real hard to find those kind of guys. There's not a lot of those kind of guys out there.
There's not. I think there. You know, it feels like there's more of what they call premium content now. You know, on TV, there's more people looking for things that have more substance to it, but.
Why do you think that is? What do you think has happened? What's the shift?
I guess I don't really know. I think I'm not in development, so I'm not really in a place to say. But I get the feeling that outlets like Netflix have really shaken up the paradigm. You know,
I think the internet in general has changed people's expectations.
Yeah.
And uncensored content is so prevalent,
right.
And so much more attractive, and
yeah.
it's just changed the way people absorb things.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think you know, listen, Netflix is, they've spent a lot of money, they've taken a lot of swings, not all of those swings have hit, but they've been pretty brave in terms of like how much and what a wide range of content they've been willing to take on.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, maybe that's, you know, part of what's driving it. I know I've been lucky enough to land at, like I said before, like 0.0 with Chris and Lydia there, and their ethos of, you know, making content that like has a purpose, you know, that works towards bettering, you know, the world, or showing people something about the world, or, you know, connecting people. And that's probably been, you know, the greatest gift. That's what brought me to Tony. That's what brought me to Steve, you know, this is a connection with them. So there are people out there that want to use the medium to,
you know,
There are idealistic suckers out there.
Well,
I'm one of them.
That's what creates that satisfying art. I mean, the stuff that we're talking about, you're not going to get that any other way. You have to have those people with that deep reverence for the subject that they're discussing and the subject that's being portrayed.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, again, more and more we have the outlets to put that on the air.
You know?
And you think back to the days when those three networks, you know. Tony's never getting on the air.
Never.
You know?
We're never going to find out about him. I mean, he'll have to stick with being an author.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know? It's in a lot of ways, it's the Wild West now, but in a lot of ways, that's a good thing.
Oh, it's a good thing. I mean, it's a great thing for me.
Yeah.
nobody would have ever given me a fucking show. It wouldn't have been that crazy.
Totally, man.
This kind of show where I go, oh, so what do you want to do? I just want to talk to whoever I want to. Who's going to schedule it? Me. What are you going to do on the show? Whatever. You're going to have a format of discussion? Nope.
But in a lot of ways, that's what Meat Eater was in the hunting version. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, what's the concept of the show? Well, I'm going to hunt the shit that I want to hunt. We're going to go to places I want to go.
Yeah.
And then hang out with the people I want to hang out with. Well, you know, are you going to shoot animals? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. It's hunting. I can't tell you. You know, right. We're going to try.
Yeah.
You know? And it was great to be able to do that and, like, have that freedom. And I think CNN, in a lot of ways, like, you know, and Tony, that you know, to have the freedom to be like, well, here's a, you know, 60-year-old, you know, ex-heroin addict. We're going to do whatever he wants to do, you know, we're going to go out wherever in the world he wants to go. And we're just going to kind of let him talk, you know?
Well, the Seattle one, I mean, they let him get blasted. I mean, he was smoking weed on camera, smoking weed through the show, going, visiting growers and then going to restaurants high as fuck. Like, you could tell he was high, and he was talking about how he'd been smoking all day. And he's on camera, man, talking about being baked with two people who are growers. The brother and sister were hilarious.
They were hilarious.
Yeah, I know. And they were laughing with him. And it's like the whole family's involved. It's really, that was a great episode, man. And it also, fuck, goddamn, that episode got me hungry. Because you see all the seafood in Seattle and all the delicious food.
Insane,
like,
man.
God, I want to get
so
up to
good.
Seattle again.
Yeah.
I haven't been up there.
No, that was a good episode. And those folks were awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I went out to that place and I filmed that, and it's like, they were like, it was like dream scenario. I mean, that kid, like, he put together.
Do you remember their names?
I'm trying to remember their names.
See if you can look find it, Jim, just to give them a shout out. No. Seattle episode, growers.
It'll come up.
African-American family.
But
they were awesome.
They were awesome. And, like, you know, that was all that kid. He had, like, put together a PDF,
mm-hmm.
and, like, showed his family. And they were like, cool, let's sink everything into it. And they did. And I went out to their place, and they were just sitting back laughing, you know, like, counting stacks of money, you know, and all smoking big joints, you know. Like, the grandma's there smoking a huge doobie. Like, and she was, like, quality control tester, you know.
That's hilarious. Yeah,
all these kids working for them and stuff, like, you know, rolling joints and making oil and all this. And, and it was just, like, I was like, man, good for you guys, you know. Like, like, way to go. Like, isn't that the way, like, kind of American entrepreneurship is supposed to work, you know?
Well, it's just rare that something comes along that's as controversial but yet also lucrative as marijuana sales. And then all of a sudden it's legal in the state.
Totally.
And you're like, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, so we could just do this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's funny. The controversial part of that episode was not Tony smoking, because that's legal and it's perfectly, you know, it's fine for him to smoke. It was when he handed the joint to me over the camera. That one was a little, I think that was a little tough for some folks to swallow.
It's, why?
You know, well, because I'm working, you know?
But he's working too.
Yeah, well, geez, you know, I never thought of it that way. I guess he was working.
Yeah, he's working too. I guess it's the idea that you're holding machinery.
Yeah, exactly, right?
The Hollingsworth.
That's exactly. Right. Shout out to the Hollingsworths.
Hollingsworth Farm.
Hollingsworth Farm. Yeah. There they are. Why was it? I guess because maybe they're thinking you're holding a machine that's, like, real expensive.
I guess, man. Or that – I think they, you know, they didn't want the perception that we were just, like,
partying
and out of control in the field. And we weren't, man. You know, we were, like, you know, we're professionals.
So did CNN have a problem with it?
I think maybe there were elements at CNN that might have had a problem.
Someone must have chimed in.
But in the end, again, to their credit, in the end, they left us alone. Like, you know?
That is the only way to make a good show.
Yeah.
As soon as those fucking cooks start coming into the kitchen and pointing at the stew and wanting to add ingredients.
Yeah, but that's the whole industry, man.
I know. That's the problem.
It's unbelievable. Again, that's why this was so refreshing, you know? It's like, how rare is it not to have people just breathing down your neck all the time?
And the same thing with Meat Eater, you know, because Steve Rinella came from The Wild Within, which was a show that's where I met him.
Yeah.
I met him from that show, and I had him on my podcast. But that show was a fucking goat rope. He was telling me that they were trying to let animals loose out of cages, and then he would shoot them.
Those were the early days when they were there were line items in for like animal wrangler and like. But you know, to everyone's credit, and like very quickly at 0.0, and very quickly with Steve, they were like, "Dude, we don't do that. Like, we're not doing that."
But it's hilarious that a producer actually came up with that idea. I know how to do this.
Producer didn't, you know, it's not like a producer came up with that idea. Right. That was just the playbook on how you make TV, right. You know? Yeah. They're just pulling from the playbook.
For sure.
You know, yeah. I mean.
Reality, air quotes, TV.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that show, I mean, listen, there's a lot of huge mistakes in that show and a lot of bullshit. Though it was, I thought it was like a pretty revolutionary and like pretty interesting show in a lot of ways. There's a lot of truth in there too. You know, we did end up going out and just like going on hunts, you know, this is a very high pressure situation, you know?
Yeah.
But also like, this is very typical of kind of like the, I think the way that television works is like still, as we're out in the field, there's still at the network, a lot of kind of infighting and jostling about what the show actually was. Is this a, you know, is this history? Is this, you know, reality? Is this, you know,
subsistence?
Yeah, you know, I remember at one point someone saying something like, well, it's not a hunting show, you know, and we're like, I'm like in the field covered in fucking moose blood, you know, right. And I'm like, well, it looks like a hunting show from where I'm standing, you know, like, yeah. I don't know what to say.
What does that mean? You know? They're saying it's not a hunting show.
Yeah, I think that there's, you know, I don't remember who that was, but I think that they're very leery of this idea of like a hunting show and what a hunting show was.
Those subsistence shows that they have, they're all hunting and gathering. I mean, that is like one of the more popular shows on all of these cable channels, where these people that live in Alaska and they're trapping.
Now
they're
it is.
Shoot. Yeah, it's crazy.
Wasn't then.
I know, it's crazy.
I mean, that genre really exploded after that.
Yeah.
And I think there's something very different, you know, when you take like, when you take Steve, the like New York City intellectual, and you put him in that environment, I think there was a different reaction than like, oh, these people live in Alaska. It's like watching pygmies hunt, you know? this is the natural environment of, you know, and that's what they do. And so hunting is acceptable under those conditions, you know?
Right.
It's like, why isn't it acceptable for someone who like lives it as like a base philosophy in their life? Give them a chance to explain why.
Right.
You know? But he lives in Brooklyn. Why would you ever hunt? You know, you live in Brooklyn. You know, you just go to the shopping center. You know?
Yeah. Well, there must be something wrong with you if you enjoy it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's part of the mentality.
Well, Tony addressed that on the show too. You know, I remember one of the first times Tony shot a deer on the show, and then they cooked it at that same guy's restaurant.
Yep. Exactly. Marco Pierre White.
Yeah.
Yep.
At his restaurant.
Yeah.
And they shot a deer and Marco put the blood on Tony's head.
Yeah, exactly.
You're supposed to do when you get your first kill.
Yeah.
And then they went and cooked it. And it was there was a lot of that. There was one time where he shot a pig at point blank range with a pistol.
Yes.
And I was like, wow, they put that on TV.
That was a big moment for him. He talked about that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. How so?
Well, I mean, that was Cajun country, right?
Yeah.
And I think that I think the story goes that they asked him to kill the pig and he goes up and like just very, very coldly double taps the pig in the head. And I think that he says there's just this moment of silence amongst the crowd. Like, oh, geez, man.
Why was that?
Like, that was cold, dude. You know?
Well, what did they expect?
I don't know. But he was like, he would talk about it as if like a gasp came up from the crowd. It was like, geez, wow. You know?
Right.
The double tap, you know? Like it's like a mob hit or something.
Yeah, I think one's enough for a pig.
I mean, I don't know,
point
man.
Point blank range.
I've seen animals shot in the head, though, that could have used another one.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I think especially, geez, I've seen a couple pigs go real ugly. So
yeah.
Double tap is totally acceptable to me because when a pig goes bad, it's not pleasant for anyone, man.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you don't want an animal ever to suffer if you,
exactly.
you see it still alive, put another one in it.
Absolutely.
That's always, bow hunting, rifle hunting.
Yep.
If it's still standing, put another one in it.
Yeah. Yeah, or suffering in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's, you know, that's like kind of a responsibility you take onto yourself when you decide to hunt. Like,
right.
And for me, when I made that decision, I've been on two hunts now with Steve. I've shot two deer. That was like a very clear kind of aspect of it. You know, it's like, well, I'm taking responsibility now, not only for like this animal's life, but for this animal's pain and suffering and the consequences of my actions, you know? So I'm not going to be lobbing off any 750-yard, you know, rifle shots because I'm not qualified to do that. And it's irresponsible to the animal and the potential suffering that you can cause, you know, or losing the animal or, you know. So, you know, and I don't know. I guess that all comes from Steve, really, you know.
At least, yeah, he's got such strong ethics.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it became really clear with me just knowing him that this guy's he's got a very, very powerful moral compass.
Yeah.
Core set of beliefs that are just non-negotiable.
Again, both of them, Tony and Steve. Yeah. I mean, Tony's moral compass is rock solid as well. You know, any mistakes that he may have made in his life, I can honestly say he made them with his heart. He made them with his moral compass in mind and making his best attempt to follow that, you know. And again, that, you know, that was something that was, it was really nice to be around and refreshing to be around, you know.
Brian, especially in this world of people with gimmicks trying to become more popular and more well-known, and he had put zero effort into that.
Yeah. I mean, just the base philosophy of the show. We're not going to fake anything. We're not going to do second takes. We're not going to...
How about the one where they were throwing frozen octopus in the water?
This is like a really famous story, right?
The
Sicily episode, yeah. He describes that as like maybe the darkest existential moment of his life, you know? It's like,
who was throwing the fake the frozen octopus?
The sidekicks. So they set up these sidekicks who were like...
Sidekicks of the guy who was running the fishing operation.
Well, I guess they were the sidekicks in the scene that we're going to work with Tony, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the way you'd set a scene up normally like that is you'd have like a sidekick, someone who's going to talk to Tony and be like, hey, what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to go out. And
the sidekick would be a local.
Yeah, usually like a local or an expert in something or, you know, a fisherman probably in this case. I wasn't on that show, so I don't know exactly. But, you know, and you'd be like, oh, we're going to go octopus. You know, do you know someone who fishes octopus? Oh, yeah, I know, you know, so-and-so. We'll go out with them, right? So, but it turned out that they went to like this very crowded beach, you know, and I think even in the scene, Tony's like, can we really catch octopus? There's like people swimming everywhere. It's like kids with like snorkel masks, you know, and they're like, yeah, everything's going to be fine. Everything's going to be fine. He got in the water and he starts hearing these plops and looks above him and there's these dead octopus like floating, you know, drifting down to the bottom of the ocean. They're lobbing them in off the boat and then picking them up as if, I got an octopus. I got one, you know. But I think, again, like most TV shows would do exactly that, you know. Like, where's the octopus wrangler? And for Tony, like that was always like completely unacceptable way to make TV.
So did you he had no idea it was going to happen before it started happening.
Once it started happening,
what did he say?
He left and went to the beach and ordered like he hit like seven Negronis in a row. He was really bummed out about it. I saw him 2 weeks later in Tokyo and he was still talking about it. He's like, I just had the worst experience of my life. Worst thing that ever happened to me. You know, darkest moment of my life, you know?
Wow. The darkest moment of his life was someone throwing frozen octopus into the water.
Yeah, because it completely went against the whole ethos of the show, you know?
But he made fun of it on the show.
Listen, honestly, it's a great scene.
It's
a great scene, largely because Sally Freeman, the producer of that, is like absolutely brilliant and one of the best directors that's ever come through that show, so...
Yeah, it was funny, too.
Like, it was
his
funny.
Take on realizing that they were throwing frozen octopus into the water.
Yeah, exactly.
And, like, how mortified he was by it all.
Yeah, totally. But, I mean, but that, again, like, that's the way it was. You know, like, we didn't go in and, like, be like, okay, action, and now cut. Okay, and now we're going to move the cameras and say that again, you know? There's none of that, man. Part of the hustle of the show was like...
being there with the camera.
Yeah, you set up the scene and then you press play and you let it go. And what happens, happens. And I'm sorry if you don't get exactly what you hoped out of it, you know, but we're not going to interrupt the world. We're not going to manipulate and control things.
That is the difference between really good reality TV. And the word reality TV is so weird. Like, what does that even mean? Because a lot of these shows, they're scripted.
Yeah.
They have these loose scenarios, and then they go in, they script them, and they redo things, they reshoot things. It's not reality. It's like shitty acting with people that are not trained, and they're edited with people talking in front of the camera like, I didn't know what Mo was thinking. I thought he was crazy. And they cut to you. It was like, I told Joe what we're going to do. He knew in advance. I didn't know shit. And then it's like it plays this conflict. Like the Kardashians. I mean, they've got it down to a fucking science. A science of moronic television viewing.
I agree.
Like if you could just sit there slack-jawed, they'll keep you locked in. They'll keep you locked in.
Sure.
They'll
good
be
at
enough
it.
Edits. They'll show you their tits. And then, boom, you cut to commercial and they're richer.
Right.
Now, that's reality TV. What you guys were doing is more documentary television.
Yeah, it is. And it's not saying that there's no affect of the convention of television there. Of course there is. But we used to say Vietnam doesn't look like that, but Vietnam doesn't not look like that. You know, there is a refinement and a manipulation in what we're doing because we're choosing these locations. We're choosing to talk to this person. We're choosing to shoot it in a certain way that's beautiful. We're adding light. You know, it's not exactly the way reality is, but there's a threshold. There's a line which you don't cross. And that line is a morally and ethically established line by Tony and by the crew that says, like, there's a place at which it becomes unfair. The manipulation of reality becomes a manipulation that has now become unfair to the people who are viewing this, to the people who are there. You know, we've become self-serving, you know, and that's the line that we chose never to cross. You know, we can make it beautiful. We can refine it down. You know, we can edit it. We can make a compelling show. But it has to exist within this certain threshold, or else what the fuck are we doing?
It must be a small percentage of people in the business that have that ethic.
Incredibly small, and it's incredibly powerful to have people backing you that believe in that, and super rare. I mean, you know, we talk about in like the film industry today how rare it is to have true auteur Final Cut directors. You know. Left. There's only a handful of them, you know. Largely the studios have taken over that control. Well, equally in the television industry, it's that rare to have people that have the kind of power and control to have the luxury of saying, you know, hey, listen, I have guidelines here and we're not going to cross them, you know, and then have people, you know, be like, great, go make it, you know. And we were able to do that. Yeah.
It seems like Netflix would be a really good place for something like that.
Yeah, it seems like Netflix would be a really good place for a lot of things.
Yeah. It seems like that's the best place for like real freedom.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I don't know how much is real freedom. When they're giving you money, anytime someone's giving you money, there's always like you got to give up a little. The real way to do it would be like to produce it yourself.
But in the end, it was CNN was the best place to do that, you know? And they really did back us up.
Yeah.
And they really backed up Tony and that philosophy. And they completely, implicitly understood what we were talking about when we said, well, we can't do that.
Now, was Jeff Zucker, was it his idea?
I don't know how the deal came about. I assume so, because I think it came in just after that transfer of power, so...
Did he have other places where he was thinking about taking it besides CNN?
Again, I don't know, I don't know. I mean, it was a really successful show in its own right at that point, so I'm sure it would have gone somewhere. But that was, I assume it was Jeff Zucker who brought it in, and that was like just such a brilliant move. It was like perfect marriage, you know. Perfect marriage, like perfect move for CNN, like perfect move for us.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when they were taking a chance on these unscripted television shows, these non-news shows.
Yeah. You've seen United Shades of America?
Yeah, I've had Kamal Bell in a couple times. He's a great guy.
He's the best, man.
He's a super, super nice guy.
Yeah, I did an episode with him in Kenya with Tony, which will be the premiere of this upcoming season.
Oh, okay.
You know, so...
How many episodes have you guys done that haven't aired yet?
Well, I think we'll have 7 in this next season. That's the only one of those seven that was actually completed with Tony's
narration.
The rest of them are incomplete and in that respect. And, you know, we've been kind of fighting through editing those over the last few months and trying to figure out ways to, you know, to do this without completely gutting, you know,
right,
the method of making this show.
Right.
You know, so.
Wow.
And then there's a couple specials in there, like, you know, talking to the crew and stuff like that, you know. So it's going to be a pretty profound season. Yeah.
So once you're done with that, you just start looking at new projects and different things to do? And
I have a couple, like, assignments already, some projects I'm, like, pretty excited about, you know. I just don't know that they've officially been announced yet, so,
right.
You know. But there's good stuff out there, and there's, you know, one nice thing in all of this incredibly difficult time is a lot of people have come to us and said, like, listen, we always believed in what you guys did, and we'd like you to continue doing it, and here's a project we have that we think, you know, so hopefully we can continue to make things with the same kind of, you know, it looks like we can.
Well, it seems like the success of the show and then the infectious enthusiasm that Tony had and that, you know, so many people who are fans of the show had for that style of television, it's just going to lead to more people taking more chances and doing things like that.
I hope so, you know. I think so. I think it's getting better, you know. There will never be another Tony. You won't find that, you know. And I think that's something that, you know, people will have to be aware of going forward. You're not going to copy that.
He's
Tony, and that's it.
Well, saw Gordon Ramsay. They announced some show with him traveling, and people immediately just start shitting all over him.
Yeah, but he's like, from everything I understand, he's like just like a really good guy, and, you know.
Well, problem is the way he portrays himself on the show, the Kitchen Nightmare show.
Yeah,
he just comes in like an asshole and yells at people that are intimidated by him. And
that's his shtick, you know. Yeah. It's his TV shtick.
Yeah.
You know? As far as I know, I don't know Gordon
Ramsay.
I met
him. Seemed nice.
Yeah.
Seemed like a real nice guy.
Yeah, yeah.
I met Guy Fieri, too. He was nice.
Yeah?
He's a nice guy. He's got crazy hair.
I got nothing against him. I don't know Guy Fieri, man.
Tony would relentlessly shit on him. And
constantly,
man.
God. Constantly. Jeez.
But he shits on everybody. Didn't he shit on Martha Ray, too?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
I think
so.
He did.
Maybe. Yeah. Well, right.
He would pull that trigger.
All the time. Dude, you always make fun of his Lamborghini. And I'm like, I'm kind of like, dude, I want a Lamborghini. What are you talking about?
It's one of those things you're not supposed to have, right? Like, you can have some cool cars. Like, I remember when he did the show with the Queens of the Stone Age, and Josh Holm, and one of the guys had a 69 Camaro.
Yeah, like, I shot that.
That
was a bad car. Yeah.
But that's an okay to have badass car because it's a classic, because it's got style points.
Totally. But I would suggest to Tony that he might want to pick up the Lamborghini because of the traction control. I think Tony would get in big problems. He'd have big problems in the Camaro.
Yeah. No, I'm sure. Yeah. As most people would. Yeah. You got to learn how to drive one of those fucking things.
That was a hot rod, man.
Yeah.
That thing was sick. I love that car.
Well, listen, brother. I'm glad we did this.
Yeah,
I'm
me
glad
too,
you reached
man.
Out.
Thank
glad
you.
We decided to get together and talk, you know. Give a lot of people insight to what it was like to work with one of my heroes.
Yeah, me too. I mean, definitely my hero.
All right.
All right.
Thanks, brother.
Thanks,
appreciate
bro.
It, man. Thank you.
Thanks, dude.